Crafting a woman professional in the long 19th century, and also the collection What is a Woman to Do? A Redrawing Women's Work and Art. She's also got a forthcoming monograph on George Eliot, The Literary Market Case and Sympathy, and has told me that her paper today comes out of her work on George Eliot, Women and the Workplace.
Thank you. Yeah, it's more of an offshoot of that monograph, imbued with all the work I've done with Tricia of the literary marketplace and related art industry. So I'm afraid it's not part of a longer scheme project. What I'm going to do today is to talk to you about Edith Simcox's cooperative shirt making and how that in a way is informed by her reading of George Eliot's novel Middlemarch and the ideas that she encountered there about community building. In 1875, the philosopher, social activist and would-be lover of George Eliot, Edith Simcox, founded with Mary Hamilton a women's only cooperative shirt-making enterprise, Hamilton & Company. Their aim was of a strictly self-supporting clothes-making factory, where women should do all the work and divide the profits among them. Simcox managed the day-to-day work of the business, which was based on 168 Dean Street in London, Soho, for 8 years. She sold her shares on the 25th of January, 1884, when she was confident that the women's only cooperative was stable financially and could continue without her. Through analysing the various facets of Simcox's participation in the national cooperative movement, retail, education, political, this paper aims to show how the type of self-sustaining professional female community she envisioned exceeds and supplants, through its pragmatism of labour, the literary narrative that, as is well known, inspired her shirt-making enterprise, George Eliot's Middlemarch. Edith Simcox had a difficult friendship with George Eliot because of her unreturned love for the latter and her corresponding rivalry with the men in the former's life, George Henry Lewes and John Walter Cross. They first met through the well-known reformer and trade unionist Emma Smith Pattinson in 1872 while she was working on a review of Eliot's novel Middlemarch for the Academy. A diary entry by Simcox from when Eliot and Lewes visited Hamilton & Company on the 13th of February 1878, gives an idea of her passionate veneration of Eliot. Came forward and lo, in the middle of the room was my goddess. She had on a spotted net veil that could have gripped me, but for the angelic way she took it off at my prayer. Apropos of the second edition of Simcox's Natural Law, we got on to the high problem of ethics. I said I was in no doubt whether to give any explanation about utilitarianism. She thought the misunderstandings of reviews hardly amounted to a presumption that one was wrong. Then they, that is Eliot and Lewes, really went. But I got yet another kiss, and I'm considerably consoled. This entry is fascinating for its long description of the intellectual debate the trios engaged in concerning Simcox's own philosophical work and utilitarianism, as well as others such as Kant, Schopenhauer, Herbert Spencer, Hegel, Mill, among others, which sits alongside the attention to detail of Eliot's dress and the language of love, desire. The role of shirt making in Eliot's and Simcox's relationship is a point to which I will return in the final section of my paper as part of my exploration of the multi-layered nature of cooperation in Simcox's enterprise. Contemporary scholarship has tended to interpret, in Gillian Beers's words, Edith Simcox solely through her place in the life of George Eliot. However, by shifting attention to the strength of her achievements as a social reformer, I aimed to focus instead on what Simcox called her experiment with cooperative shirt making. This grew out of the establishment of the Third Women's Union in the clothing trade, the Shirt and Collar Markers Union, at a public meeting held on the 1st of July 1875 in St. Martin's Schoolroom near Covent Garden. Simcox worked with leading social reformers such as Annie Besant, Charles Bradlaugh, Harriet Law, and William Morris. The success of her women-only shirt-making cooperative gave credibility to her other reform efforts, which aimed to bring working and middle-class women into contact with each other. And this is an important point to which I will return. For example, Simcox was one of the first women to be admitted as a delegate at the Trade Union Congress in 1875, together with Emma Patterson, who was at the time an honorary secretary of the Women's Protective and Provident League, a society for promoting the formation of independent self-supporting trade and benefit associations for women. Simcox campaigned tirelessly for the rights of trade unions. Taking Simcox's turn to cooperation as part of the changing significance of work for women in the Victorian period, my argument is that Eliot's experiments in life with Middlemarch assisted and influenced Simcox's views towards the pragmatics of female labour, as it was expressed through her cooperative enterprise and trade unionism. The organisation of women's industry, Simcox states in her conclusion to an article on women's work and women's wages from 1887, will help the community to understand that every sound economic principle applies to women as well as to men, and it is therefore hardly utopian to believe that a good day may come, and even quickly, when we shall all see that the labour of starving work girls is not really even cheap, while the conditions under which it is brought and sold are quite intolerably nasty, and such as must be relentlessly prescribed by an unduly enlightened public opinion. As Gary Holloway has pointed out, up through 1914, laundry work, domestic service, and manufacturing were still the main employments of working class women, in spite of the new opportunities in shop and clerical work. Although the narrative of Victorian women's engagement with the professions is in general a middle-class woman's story, Simcox's undertaking to represent the interests of the working classes through Hamilton and Company diversifies the debate about the female quest for purposeful work and questions the assumption that concomitant discourses about status and respectability solely reflect the middle-class domination of the social and cultural landscape. David Bradshaw and Suzanne Osman have noted that where there was no shortage of debate about what underemployed middle-class women were to do, a much greater number of women born into much worse circumstances received much less attention. As such, this paper aims to complement the extensive scholarship on representations of working-class women's labour, the figure of the seamstress being the obvious example, as well as that on the way working class women express their experience of work and the need for trade unions and factory reform. It is precisely Simcox's shift of attention away from the gulf between the occupations and interests of men and women to the opportunities for remunerative employment between working and middle class women that makes Simcox occupy such a unique position in the debate about female labour in the Victorian period. While the first section of my paper will look into Simcox's reading of Eliot's Middlemarch and the ways in which it informs her understanding of cooperation as an antidote to the alienating forces of industrial capitalism, the second section will examine the way in which the pragmatism of her labour was expressed through her cooperative enterprise and trade unionism as part of a broader crisis in middle-class women's liberal education. Joyce Pedersen has argued that liberal feminist arguments concerning female labour attempted to move beyond socioeconomic markers of class. Her work traces the way in which women spoke in terms of differences of education or intelligence rather than differences of wealth or market position. Working within as well as against the grain of the Marxist narrative of struggle, Simcox imagined an idea of cooperation within competition, which could eventually enable the alienated female worker to overcome the divisions of labor. Okay. Now, I will move to the first section of the paper where I will focus on Simcox's reading of Middlemarch. In this novel, on which Simcox wrote some of his finest criticism under the pseudonym of H. Loreni in the Academy of January the 1st, 1873, Eliot reworks Robert Owen's complete community ideal, which comprised high-minded men and women like Lydgate and Dorothea, working together in a Midlands market town, albeit both characters do so in order to meet their own desires and misplaced ambitions. Simcox's review tellingly describes Lydgate as a masculine counterpart of Dorothea, with the relative proportions of head and heart reversed. And through their characters, offers a trenchant analysis of those working men and women whose lives are cut in two, whose intellectual interests have no direct connection with their material selves. Unlike Dorothea's and Lydgate's lack of self-consciousness, Simcox's recognition of the conflict between high-minded ideals and material reality, which underlines her reading of Middlemarch, is key to the efforts, to her efforts, to create a practical, self-employing professional community of intelligent working women at Hamilton and Company. In contrast to other reviewers of Middlemarch, for example Henry James, who criticized the novel for the parallels between Dorothea and Lydgate, Simcox did not find it an indifferent whole. According to Simcox's review, Middlemarch differs from Eliot's other narratives because its psychological realism gives insight into all the subtle factors which make up the character of a definite state of society: the busy idleness, its trade, its politics, its vestry meanings. Novels such as Silas Marner, Simcox continues, Romola, Felix Holt the Radical, or even The Mill on the Floss, in which the reader encounters another shirt maker and novel by Pei's work, Maggie Taliaferro, are an idealization, and hence do not inspire us with the same confidence of truths we can verify for ourselves. For that reason alone, on the mere point of artistic harmony of construction, we should rate the last work as the greatest, and to say that Middlemarch is George Eliot's greatest work. The point Simcox makes here about the artistic harmony of Eliot's novel is that for her, in contrast to James, the novel is an organic whole. Ruth Livesey has recently pointed out that Eliot's later novels paradoxically acknowledge the separation formed by different sorts of social environments and insist on the need to communicate despite these divisions. One of the many merits of Middlemarch, Simcox claims in her review, is that it shows the inadequacy of all other less arduous shortcuts to the reformation of society by exposing its underlying truth, that is, the fact that the real and the ideal sides of our common nature do coexist in such relations. Ideal and real, mind and matter, intellectual aspirations and material circumstances all exist in conflicting, yet overlapping and dialectical relationships. It is precisely Eliot's recognition of the interconnected nature of these paradigms that informs Simcox's understanding of cooperation as a means of combining, with the help of trade unions, individual aspirations with material circumstances. Simcox's own definition of the word cooperative, which she set out in an article for Fraser's Magazine from 1882, has a number of affinities with the type of community building promoted in Middlemarch. In contrast to the West End householder who viewed the cooperative simply as institutions for cheap grocery, or the political economists who saw a cooperative as an ideal method of production, as promising the long-desired reconciliation of capital and labor, Sipcock's view through the eyes of the working class worker, cooperation as a struggle for opportunity to become his own employer and a participatory in the profits of his own labor. And before I move to discuss the pragmatics of Sipcock's labor as expressed through cooperation and trade unionism, I would like to conclude this section with one of the anecdotes that Sipcock narrates in her article, 8 Years of Cooperative Shirt Making for the 19th Century in 1884, which provides an account of the material challenges she faced in her efforts to establish Hamilton & Company as a successful cooperative business. The extract on your screen outlines the role that the popularity of Eliot's fiction played in securing a workshop, though expensive, for the women-only cooperative. And it gives an interesting example of the place that Eliot has in Sipcock's activism, in spite of Eliot's own unease with direct political action. We began our quest in what appears superficially the most desirable streets, and as we descended gradually in the social scale, we found that we might have been accepted had we wanted a studio or a school, or even a milliner shop. But as shirt makers, we must betake ourselves to humbler and more expensive quarters. As I told amateurs, we could get a good house in a quiet street for £80, together with all the differential civility due to highly desirable tenants. As working shirt makers, after refreshing our radicalism with a glimpse of the oppressor's scorn, the proud man's contumely, we were fortunate in securing half a house for £90 under a landlord whose exceptional amenity explained itself afterwards when we learned he was an admirer of George Eliot's works. I will say more about the politics of shirt making in the second section of my paper, but what is to the fore here is that the rooms available to Sipcock and her fellow labourers reflect the gap between needlework as an amateur middle-class hobby and shirt-making as a radical cooperative enterprise for professional working and lower middle-class women. Luckily, George Eliot helped to save the day, and as with this unnamed but sympathetic landlord, Sipcock's fascination with Middlemarch was because of its combination of material interest and ideal aspirations that interview were key to protecting waged female workers from exploitation in the workplace. Okay, so now we can move to the pragmatics of Sipcock's own labor. What is interesting about Sipcock's reading of Middlemarch as a double narrative of struggle and opportunity is that it is not troubled by or disappointed from what Elaine Showalter called the self-sacrificing masochism of Eliot's characters, and more particularly her heroines. At the beginning of the novel, Dorothea, fresh from her liberal education in Switzerland, idealistically embarks on a project to improve the lot of the local poor by building model cottages. However, when she tries to inspire Sir James Chedham with her plans, he pays only lip service to them as part of his attempted courtship. Sipcock critiques Dorothea's unproductive charity as part of a crisis in middle-class women's liberal education that was too caught up in its own idealism. To keep society alive, Sipcock states in her review, is perhaps a worthier mission than to cheer the declining years of Mr. Cosabon, but to do more than keep it alive, to make it fit home for future Dorotheas, the present supply of such missionaries would have to be increased. And they are born, not made. It is not stretching things too far to suggest that Sipcock recognized herself in Dorothea's well-meaning aspirations for social reform as she undertook to improve the lot of the working classes. Being of an upper middle-class background, Sipcock came of age in the decade of the redundant woman and spent her girlhood reading of novels whose philanthropic heroines put their ambitions in the service of the poor. Rosemary Bodenheimer has pointed out that Sipcock's writing, ranging from her periodical essays on cooperation, trade unionism, and women's wage work, to her secret diary, the autobiography of a shirt maker, veers from one ideal to the other. In so doing, it dramatizes the lived struggle of her quest for a story, affording us a view of a woman, perhaps even a generation of mid-century women, for whom the George Eliot model of sympathetic womanhood was both fatally compelling and deeply flawed. In this section of my paper, I will examine how Simcox tries to make society a fit home for future Dorotheas through her preoccupation with the pragmatics of her own labour. Shirt making was a trade in which the average wages were notoriously inadequate for the maintenance of the female worker. It was not seen as a respectable source of livelihood for middle-class women as the art industries in the period. Industrial forms of art such as designing, painting on pottery, the decoration of houses and furnishing, art needlework, photography, wood engraving, and modeling in clay and wax were considered as female occupations because they were seen as natural extensions of women's training in the accomplishments. The same merchandise that could be created by women for sale in charity bazaars or to decorate their own homes could be produced on a more industrial scale, according to more business-like principles. And this understanding made the transition from pastime to profession easier for a number of types of employment. In her 87-9 essay on the industrial employment of women, however, for Fraser's magazine, Simcox suggests that these industries failed in sustaining profitable employment for women due to the lack of cooperative organization and trade unionization. She proposes that the only practical alternative remaining is an attempt to organize the unskilled and remunerative industries in question on a footing which shall be economical, insofar as self-supporting and insofar as self-supporting and uneconomical, as the fact of unremunerativeness is recognized and acquiesced. A precedent may be found for this compromise in the course taken by various societies for improving the dwelling of the working classes. As a commercial speculation, it pays better for individuals to run rent hovels than to build model lodgings. But as a safe and sober investment, model lodging houses may be preferred to South American loans. And anyway, there is no economic law to forbid persons who have saved money for laying it out by preference in a way which they think incidentally conducive to public welfare and morality. Simcox locates the failings of the domestic industries as self-sustaining businesses in their reliance on the unproductive charity of the enterprising Dorotheas of this world. In spite of appreciating their aspirations for reform and the network of support they offered, in her view, they did not have the skills of organizing and administering a trade society or the expertise and infrastructure provided by cooperative communities and trade unions, which worked for the legal and industrial rights of the workers. They also lacked the hard-nosed commercial moves that was needed to compete with the slop work of the sweatshops, and that had limited impact on securing stable incomes for working women. It is important to note here that Simcox's selection of shirt making as a trade was a political decision through which she tried to demonstrate the potential of alternative forms of economic and cooperative organization. Simcox could presumably have chosen any number of potential garments for her enterprise. Yet, I want to argue that there are very specific reasons behind the choice of cooperative shirt making. The most important of these is not to do with the shirt itself, but the political and economic charge attached to the shirt making, which forms part of the larger established discourse about the economic exploitation of the Victorian seamstress and of working class labor more generally. Victorian culture is famously littered with portrayals of exploited seamstresses, but shirt making in particular was renowned for its low pay and for exemplifying a pernicious mode of capitalist exploitation. Thomas Hood's Song of the Shirt, published in Punch on 16th December 1843, is probably the most famous critique of this. Many other representations besides Hood, though, portrayed the seamstress being abused not by making fine dresses for aristocratic women, but more specifically, shirts. The politics and iconography of the shirt were everywhere, and this ideological charge gives a radical dimension to Simcox's cooperative shirt making, through which he tried to connect, as she put it, the working class women who work and the middle class women who buy. Thus, in addition to Hood, in G.W.M. Reynolds' The Seamstress, All the White Slaves of England from 1853, shirt making is again used as an example of the exploitation of the sweatshop system. Shirt making is the most degraded form of labor that the heroine, Virginia, is reduced to when she has no other option. In fact, it was the old system of Mrs. Jackson, Mrs. Pembroke, and Madame du Plessis all over again, with the substitution of other names and lower wages. In fact, poor Virginia was now engaged in making slop shirts at 2d/farthing a piece. Yes, shirts at 2d/farthing each, and by dint of toiling from 6 in the morning up 12 at night, she was enabled to make 3 in a day. Ah, but a day of 18 hours, leaving the poor girl only 6 hours which she could call her night, and during those 18 hours she earned precisely 6d/3d, out of which she had to purchase the thread. Every shirt had 7 buttonholes, 3 to the bosom, 2 to the collar, and 1 to each wristband. And the sewing must be neatly done, or the poor seamstress would have to pay for the spoiled work. Virginia eventually dies of consumption in the novel, and Reynolds again uses that to attack the sweating system that is established by the middle class to prey on the working classes. That's the assumption behind it. Now, there is an equally rich number of prints and paintings that repeat the same narrative. In Richard Redgrave's very well-known painter, The Poor Seamstress, from 1846, the lonely seamstress is shown with a man's shirt. And the focus is not the milliner's shop, but the piecework done at home. Lynn Alexander has suggested that the choice of a masculine garment, shirt as a masculine garment, reflects the role of patriarchy in creating this woman's plight. What might have been a loving task for a wife, Alexander notes, daughter or mother, now becomes a foreboding symbol. Other examples of this genre include John Leech's 1849 cartoon from Punch, Pin Money, Needle Money, in which the seamstress is again sewing or mending a shirt. Anna Elizabeth Blunden's The Seamstress, A Song of a Shirt, from 1854. Charles Radford's Wherry, from 1881, which again shows the isolated seamstress mending a shirt, looking longingly at the open sky. That's the wrong image, isn't it? That's the one that she looks outside at the open sky beyond her garret window, and that's obviously the one that she falls asleep because of her tiredness of trying to mend the shirt. So what I'm trying to give you with these examples is that there are ample representations, both in literature and in painting, which start from the early 19th century, but they actually last up until the end of the century, and the length of this tradition stretches through to Margaret Harkness' novel, A Manchester Shirtmaker, which was published under the pseudonym of John Law in 1890. Harkness was a socialist and a feminist, and like so many others before her, attacked the economics of the sweating system, but interestingly also sought to undermine the belief that that the sewing machine was a panacea that would improve the lot of the female seamstress. In the novel, Mary Dillard, a widow with an infant, is forced to give up making fancy dress work as she's unable to make ends meet and ends up living in a Manchester slum. Once in the slum, she sees an advertisement for shirt makers. Another shirt maker informs her of the difficulties of earning and living made by making shirts. 10 pence a dozen for men's shirts, 8 pence, and 6 pence a dozen for boys' shirts. It used to be a penny each to make and finish, but now they have old women in the warehouse finishing. I dare say you have seen them. Things never were so bad as they is now in the shirt trade. I mean, you can kind of notice again with the deliberate ungrammatical language that the working class language is supposed to be registered. So the novel details the hard work, poor pay, and the lack of respect that accompanied shirt making, despite technological advances such as the sewing machine. There are many other literary and pictorial portrayals of shirt making I could have chosen, but my point is that Simcox's enterprise selected shirt making not because of the shirt in itself, but because it is the garment the most associated with a particular middle-class model of economic exploitation of the working class. Working against the grain of these pictures of the isolated and alienated seamstress, Simcox offers community and cooperation at Hamilton & Company. Her cooperative principles were a considered intervention in a trade renowned for its sweatshop organization. Interestingly, Simcox notes that in union meetings, Hood's Song of the Shirt was frequently cited, but it is no longer enjoyed, she says, in the same way, and it doesn't have the same hold it used to have upon the women she employed, who were more respected and affluent than the distressed figure represented in his poem. There is one final aspect of Simcox's enterprise that is notable in the light of the sweatshop practices associated with shirt making, where everything is endlessly subcontracted out at piece rates. The shirt making endeavor was initially a failure, and in her account of the 8 years of cooperative shirt making at Hamilton & Company, Simcox spends a great deal of time on the unthinking mistakes that she and Mary Hamilton made, which were in part due to their lack of technical education in organizing and administrating a trade corporation, taking on too many workers at too high wages for the jobs they received, being undercut by competitors who dislike their modus operandi, and being too concerned with being an emblem of social reform rather than making the cooperative prosper as a business. I mean, quite characteristically, Simcox opens that article by pointing out that they deliberately avoided to use the word cooperative in their brand, and they named it Hamilton & Company because they wanted to overcome prejudice or use it as a safeguard against prejudice. Simcox's report on the material circumstances under which she set up her own cooperative reads as much like a hard-headed entrepreneur as a committed trade unionist. But through this effort, she put into understanding the pragmatics of setting up a cooperative enterprise. She was able to answer the question that Thomas Carlyle once posed, and which in her view was key to understanding the principles of success in cooperative shirt making, of how, with all the talk of distressed needlewomen, he could find nobody to mend his shirts for one day. Simcox's answer to this was how did the philosopher expect the needlewoman to maintain herself on all the other days of the year when his clothes didn't actually want mending? And it was only in the case that a number of families cooperated together that cooperatives could ensure that they could supply enough regular work for a seamstress to be always available when desired. As she pithily notes, whether they solved Carlyle's problem to his satisfaction or not at the Hamilton and Company, they did not know, but they did supply all the shirts for him and his brother. In acknowledging the importance of the connection of the cooperatives to the community, Sidcup rests her hopes with ethical consumerism. She basically refers to the consumer. And she says that the only real and effective perfection that can be extended to the world girl must come from a universal conspiracy of consumers, not to buy the produce of stolen or half-paid for labour, spending, of course, the money so economised in employing at first hand a corresponding number of women at trade society wages. I would like now to conclude my paper by thinking through the connotations of Simcox's shirt-making cooperative for community building by returning to her difficult relationship with George Eliot. While Simcox created collectivity encompassing different classes of working women through her experimentation with cooperation, she personally deployed her shirt making as a means of ingratiating herself with George Eliot and George Henry Lewes. She used the shirts she made as part of a gift economy to become a slightly awkward member of their community and the circle of admirers that competed for Eliot's affection at her home, the Priory. I just want to give you one example of how this works because of the implications that it carries about the multi-layered nature of cooperation in Simcox's shirt-making enterprise. Thus, at the end of May 1878, Simcox meets Lewes and Eliot by chance outside the Dinsin establishment, where they are returning some of Lewes's shirts to be mended, and which Simcox obviously takes them from them. Her diary entry of the 2nd of June 1878 makes evident the way that the erotics of their relationship, at least on Simcox's side, functions around the shirt and material she's able to provide. The following quotation, I know it's long, but it has a cumulative effect that is revealing in terms of Simcox's measuring her life not by coffee spoons, but by her encounters with Eliot, often concerning clothing and these accounts of her encounters with Eliot are full of a sublimated eroticism. Still self-deniedly sent the parcel of mended shirts by a girl. On next Tuesday, 14th, he was ushered, that is Lewes, upstairs bringing another parcel, and when I heard she was in the carriage, I rushed down rather unsteadily, stood on the pavement kissing her hand and was made happy to being asked to get pattern or soft, slim silk for summer wear. Wrote next day to send items and called on Friday for an answer, which got both by paper and word of mouth. Again, did not stay long, got leave to send a certain white silk nightgown to let her see if she could wear a morning dress of the same. On Friday, I went with fresh patterns of silk. Johnny was there, and she asked me to come some other day, Sunday or Monday or Tuesday. Returning home through Kensington Gardens, if truth must be told, I sat down under a spreading tree and cried. On Wednesday, was in doubt whether to take or send another variety of silk, at last resolved to take it. The servant made me come in. She was very tired, but as I kissed her, her cheek pressed caressingly against mine. She threw the folds of silk around Lewes to see the effect in a mass, and as her hand passed near him, he sees it, even as I do, and left the kiss thereon. One of the things through which I am thankful through every jealous pain is the perfectness of the lance binding these two together. there are a number of things that might be said about the life Simcox describes for herself. Each moment of physical contact is lingeringly recorded. She acknowledges her jealousy towards Louis even while declaring their ideal partnership. And the merest hint of rejection leaves her crying at Kensington Gardens. And all through this, the patterns of silk and shirts create the channel of communication. And when Simcox describes her disillusionment with her shirt-making enterprise, which was taking up a significant commitment of her time and energy, she implicitly acknowledges she will carry on with it, not because of the political ideals it embodies, but because Eliot once remarked to her about the usefulness of the silk pattern she was able to provide. It is probably fair to say that the psychodynamics of this relationship does not seem the healthiest. Eliot continues to loom large over the shirt making, the garment Simcox makes touching Eliot's skin in a matter she would desire. Trade unionism may not be in Simcox's words any more than cooperation, a panacea for all the evils and dangers of our industrial system, but neither is George Eliot. And while her fellow labourers at Hamilton and Company were honestly paid for each stage of their production without being starved or brutalized, in Simcox's words, at the beating of the public's heedless craving for an illusory cheapness, Simcox struggled with the George Eliot model of sympathetic womanhood that was both fatally compelling and deeply flawed. And this leaves us with a question whether her experiment with cooperative shirt making ended up becoming a middle-class woman story, but whose multi-layered nature carries the possibility to undermine it from within.